Welcome to the deep dive, where we really extract the core insights from your submitted materials, making you instantly well-informed.
And today, we're focusing in on a really interesting source, episode 35 of the Military Tales YouTube channel. It features an interview with Lee Maz Mazzarella, a pilot from the 1st Special Operations Squadron.
Exactly. And you, our listener for this deep dive, you want to get the essential knowledge from this full interview, but, you know, quickly and thoroughly.
Right. You're after those aha moments, that clear understanding, but maybe without getting totally lost in the weeds of a long interview.
So our mission today, unpack Mazzarella's time flying the A-1 Skyraider back in 1972. He was based out of a Nikon Phantom NKP. They called it Naked Fanny.
Mm-hmm. And we'll also cover his earlier stuff flying F-4s and kind of how his career path went after the A-1s.
Okay, sounds like a plan. Let's get right into it.
All right. So Mazzarella, his call sign was Mass. He was flying Skyraiders with the 1st Special Ops at NKP in Thailand. This is February to November 1972.
And the Skyraider, the A-1, that's the propeller plane, right? Yeah. Older, but known for carrying a lot of ordnance.
Exactly. A real workhorse for close air support. Could stay up a long time, carry a heavy load. And he tells this story about a mission at a place called Kilometer 21. Really highlights the A-1's role.
Kilometer 21, wasn't that the base shaped like a triangle with a hill in the middle?
That's the one. So he and his wingman get called in, troops in contact, very close to the tree line.
Yeah.
Like 50 meters away.
50 meters. Wow, that's incredibly close. And weren't there usually pretty strict rules about dropping ordnance near friendlies?
Yeah, absolutely. Standard procedure was usually a 200-meter safety buffer, you know, to avoid friendly fire incidents.
Okay. But the A-1, it could do things differently.
Precisely. It could operate low and slow, deliver ordnance with surprising accuracy right where it was needed. So Mazzarella's talking directly to the guys on the ground.
And they're under heavy fire right at the edge of the trees.
Right there, desperate for help. Ground control is hesitating a bit on the clearance because of that 200-meter rule.
It's a tense moment, man.
Mazzarella basically says, look, the enemy is right there, well within what he knows the A-1 can safely hit. He asks them, you know, do you want the bombs or not?
And they said.
The call came. Let her go. So he put the ordnance right on that tree line.
Incredible. So the key insight there is really about pilot judgment and the aircraft's capability kind of overriding standard procedure in an emergency.
I think so, yeah. It shows that adaptability, the calculated risk, the rules weren't always rigid, and pilots had to trust their skills and their plane when things got critical. Really shows the impact of CAS when it's done right.
Definitely paints a picture. And he contrasts that kind of up-close fight with his earlier missions, right? Flying F-4 Phantoms.
Yeah, he did 100 missions in the backseat of F-4s over North Vietnam. Totally different kind of war, he says.
How so? What were the targets like there?
Much more defined. Railway yards, the Dahmer Bridge, a big strategic target, SAM sites. Things you could generally see. Open targets for fast jets like the F-4.
Okay, visible targets. But then flying missions in Laos was different again?
Completely. He described it as just dense green jungle. Very hard to see anything specific. They relied heavily on coordinates.
Coordinates, like map references?
Yeah, you know, bomb this river bend or go this distance from that point. Bombing based on estimations, suspected locations, not usually direct visual confirmation of the enemy. You'd look for secondary explosions sometimes through the trees.
Big difference between dropping bombs right on a visible tree line and hitting coordinates in the jungle.
Huge difference in the type of flying and targeting.
Okay, so after the intensity of A-1 close air support, let's talk about these sandy missions he flew. Search and rescue, right?
That's right. He flew several sandy missions, leading two of them. He mentions one over the Black River in North Vietnam.
What happened there?
Without confirming the survivor was okay and where he was.
Too risky.
Makes sense. But you mentioned something about his previous experience being crucial.
Yeah, this is interesting. From his earlier tour flying F-4s, he had apparently memorized all these delta points in Laos.
Delta points. What are those exactly? Like navigation markers.
Kind of, yeah. Recognizable geographical features.
Yeah.
He mentioned things like a tall piece of wreckage from a car, a rock formation they called the Fish's Mouth, Magia Pass, distinct landmarks.
And why were these important?
Well, they were often flying VFR visual flight rules. So knowing these points and the headings and distances between them was critical for navigating accurately without relying solely on instruments, especially over terrain that could look very similar.
So it was like having a mental map.
Exactly. He even said his wingman on that Black River mission was surprised because Mazzarella was navigating using maps of South Vietnam, but confidently calling out turns based on his memory of those Laotian Delta points.
That's impressive recall under pressure. He also mentioned prairie fire missions.
Mm-hmm. Those were in northern Laos, specifically near the Plain of Jars.
Ah, the Plain of Jars. Famous archaeological site, right. But the big stone jars.
That's the one. He knew it from National Geographic, he said. Not really something you can make out clearly from the air. And there were specific rules there.
Restrictions on bombing.
Yeah, they absolutely could not attack the Plain of Jars itself. It was understood to be, you know, a significant burial site, off limit.
But they could operate nearby.
Yes. If friendly forces were in contact with the enemy nearby, or if they identified specific enemy supply depots in the vicinity, then they had permission to engage. Shows those complex rules of engagement again.
Right. It wasn't just fly anywhere, shoot anything. Okay, let's talk about his career path. It wasn't just A1s and F4s.
Not at all. It's quite a journey. He started, as we said, backseat in the F4, even volunteered for the MiG killer squadron at Ubon.
Says something about wanting to be in the fight.
Definitely. Then he upgraded to the front seat of the F4, piloting the Phantom himself.
And then the C-141. That seems like a big shift. Transport aircraft.
Yeah, a really unusual move for a fighter pilot, he admitted. Flew the C-141 Starlifter, those big cargo planes, for about 2 years. Flew all over the world, apparently, except over India for some reason.
But the fighter pilot bug didn't leave him.
Clearly not. Because when his C-141 squadron was shutting down, he proactively put in a request to go back to Vietnam, specifically asking for A-1s.
He has to go back to combat in Sky Raiders.
Yep. Knew their value, wanted to be part of that close air support mission again.
Wow. What else? Didn't he help out the A7 guys?
He did. Later on, he helped the A7 Corsair 3 good community with their SAR training. He'd actually volunteer to be the downed pilot in exercises up in northern Thailand. Pretend to be the guy needing rescue.
And he almost got checked out in the A7 in Vietnam.
Came close, but it got blocked because it would have been a consecutive combat tour, which wasn't allowed.
But he flew them later. And other planes, too.
Oh, yeah. Flew A-7s for 3.5 years, then transitioned to the A-10 Warthog for 4 years.
A tank bust.
Mm-hmm. And finally, he flew F-16s, ended up as a colonel, director of operations in Zaragoza, Spain. So F-4, C-141, A-1, A-7, A-10, F-16. Quite the list.
That's a heck of a career path through some legendary aircraft. Now, something really unique he talked about was his E&E bracelet, Escape and Evasion.
Ah, yes. This is a great story. So context first. When he arrived for his A1 tour, aircraft losses were high. He mentioned something like 28 or 29 aircrafts from the unit had already been lost.
So the risk of getting shot down and captured was very, very real.
Extremely real. And the thinking behind the bracelet was, well, paper money might be useless if you're shot down, but precious metals, silver, gold, that might have actual value for bartering or bribing your way out of trouble.
Okay, so he had a bracelet made.
Sterling silver with a gold inlay. The idea was, worst case scenario, maybe you could trade for help, for food, for escape.
Makes sense. But there was a twist, right? A realization he had.
Mm-hmm. He's at the bar one night and someone points out, hey, Maz, someone might just kill you for that bracelet. Forget bribing. They might just take it.
Oh, right. That changes the calculation a bit.
Right.
So what did he do?
He had something engraved on the back, something rather blunt.
Okay.
It read, if I am laying cold and dead and you are stealing this from my body, fuck you.
Slight pause. Wow. Okay. That's direct.
He figured the sentiment would probably get across, even if they couldn't read English. Kind of a final defiant message. He related it to that Caesar quote, you know, a coward dies 1,000 deaths, a brave man dies but once.
It's such a personal, almost darkly funny way to deal with that constant danger. Really humanizes it.
Absolutely. It's a powerful little detail. Now, switching back to the flying, he described two specific SAR missions where they actually got guys out. The first one involved his friend, Tex Brown.
Okay, what happened on that one?
This was south of Da Nang. An army helicopter got shot down, crew wounded on the ground, one badly burned, apparently.
And the situation was messy.
Very. Unclear front lines. The ground commander was, understandably, very cautious. The initial restriction was basically, you can come in, but you can't fire back unless you confirm the target isn't friendly. Super restrictive.
And wasn't there something else complicating things? Navy fire?
Yeah, the Navy was conducting fire missions overhead, which effectively trapped the A-1s down low, like 2,000 feet or maybe even less, for about 3 hours. They couldn't climb out safely.
Stuck low, with wounded guys on the ground and tight rules. What about rescue helicopters?
Initially, the Air Force helos were reluctant to go in without being cleared hot. you know, able to return fire immediately if shot at.
Understandable.
But then 6 Army helicopters showed up. 2 Hueys, 2 Loaches, he called them Ouchies, probably OH-6s, and 2 Cobra gunships. And they were willing to go in with the understanding that they'd fire back if fired upon.
Okay, so they had rescuers ready to go.
Right. Tex Brown held high cover, and Mazzarella led the Army helos in. He turned on his rotating beacon so they could see him clearly.
And did they take fire?
Immediately. Heavy tracer fire came up. Tex's plane took 9 hits. Mazzarella took 4. Small arms fire, but still.
And didn't they have an even closer call?
Yeah. During all this, in broad daylight, a shoulder-fired, heat-seeking missile zipped right between their 2 A1s.
Unbelievable. And fuel must have been getting critical by then.
Yeah, definitely. They had been airborne almost 5 hours. When they finally got back to land south of Da Nang, Tex Brown blew a tire on landing it had been shot. His plane blocked the runway.
So Mazzarella couldn't land right away?
Nope. Already low on fuel, he had to do a go-around while they cleared the runway, just adding to the stress.
But they got the Army guys out.
They did. Rescued all 6 Army personnel. And what's really telling is the award they received for that mission wasn't self-reported. It was initiated by the soldiers they rescued.
That speaks volumes. Did he ever hear from them again?
Apparently not. Just one of those intense moments in combat, and then everyone moves on.
Wow. And there was a second SAR incident he described, also with Tex Brown.
Yes. This one involved a NOTAMs notice.
Okay, remind us. NOTAMs.
Basically, a notice to airmen warning about naval gunfire support active in a specific area. A danger zone, essentially.
And the downed survivor was in that zone.
Right in the middle of it. So Tex was on the radio, trying desperately to get the Navy to cease fire in that specific grid.
How did they find the survivor?
Instead of using smoke, which might draw enemy fire, the survivor used an orange panel to signal his location. Smart move.
So Mazzarella had to spot this panel.
He flew in tight formation with Tex, using their eyes to scan the ground and visually locate that orange panel. And while they were doing this, low and focused.
Not another missile.
Yep, another shoulder-fired missile came up at them. Mazzarella saw it, yelled, "Break right!" Instantly. And they both yanked their planes into an evasive maneuver.
Just pure reaction?
Exactly. He made a point of contrasting it with movies, you know, like Top Gun, where there's often a delay before reacting. He stressed it was instantaneous. Split-second survival.
It really underscores the constant threat, the sheer speed needed to just stay alive up there. So, wrapping this deep dive up, what are the big takeaways for you from Mazzarella's stories in that episode 35?
Well, I think it gives you such a visceral, personal look at what aerial warfare in Vietnam entailed. You see the huge range of demands on these pilots.
Yeah, from that incredibly close, dangerous air support.
To the calculated risks of searching for downed guys, often alone, relying on skill, and sometimes pure luck. And the importance of just knowing the terrain, those delta points.
We definitely got those aha moments, seeing how precise CAS had to be, how vital visual navigation was, and just how incredibly dangerous those SAR missions were, constant risk.
And that E&E bracelet story is just such a surprising, raw, human detail amidst all the tactics and machinery, that defiant message on the back.
It really sticks with you. So maybe a final thought for you, the listener. Think about that human element, beyond the planes, beyond the strategies. It's about quick thinking. It's about camaraderie under fire. And sometimes it's about these really unexpected personal things, like an engraved bracelet.
Right. What other stories, what other human layers are hidden inside these historical accounts that seem straightforward on the surface? Definitely something to think about.